Welcome, everyone, to the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. I was reflecting on our bedrock values, and I think it's free speech, free expression, critical thinking, civic participation, and that is what we're going to do tonight. So that is very exciting. Two great candidates for the assembly who've come to debate issues, and a wonderful panel that you'll hear about in just a second. But it's my privilege always to introduce you to our moderator, and that is our professor of emeritus political science, someone who is certainly no stranger to anyone who has followed political issues in this area over the past decades, and that is Professor Emeritus Joe Heim. So please welcome him.
As Chancellor said, I'm Joe Heim, the moderator, and for this debate between the candidates running for the Wisconsin State Assembly District 94, that includes virtually everything in La Crosse County except the city of La Crosse. I'd like to welcome you and welcome the two candidates, incumbent Democrat Representative Steve Doyle on your left. I don't know if that's a political question or not. And his challenger, Republican Albert Rowland. And this debate is sponsored by the following people. It's going to take me a few seconds for this. UW-La Crosse University, the La Crosse Tribune, WKBT Channel News 8, WXOW News 19, WLSU, WPR, Midwest Family Broadcasting, and the League of Women Voters. On campus, the co-sponsors, Joint Legislative Affairs Committee, the Faculty Senate, the UWL Student Association, the Academic Staff Council, University Staff Council, Political Science Department, and the Poli Sci Association. So they'll get through that, huh? Now, the questions are coming from a very distinguished panel of friends and colleagues. Martha Kolaski, news anchor from WKBT News 8, welcome. Mark Wares, local news editor of the La Crosse Tribune. Third, Dave Soley, WXOW News 19. Fourth, Hope Kirwan, reporter for WLSU, WPR. Number five, Brad Williams, reporter for WISM and Midwest Family Broadcasting. And last but not least, Catherine Kolkmeyer, League of Women Voters. Catherine. And the timekeeper is Charlene Roberts from the League of Women Voters. Okay. Now, the format for the debate, just to kind of go over there very quickly. Opening statements, each candidate gets 3 minutes, and they've already agreed who's going to go first. That'll be followed by questions from the members of the panel, and each candidate gets 2 minutes to respond. If they wish, they can respond 30 seconds to something that their opponent says, okay? Near the closing, you know, we've got about 5 minutes to go in the hour. We have to time this pretty carefully. Closing statements will be 2 minutes each. And a couple other quick notices. One is, please turn off your phones. iPhone did mine before we got here. So, start off with, please welcome the two candidates, Steve Doyle and Albert Rowland. Okay, and Mr. Doyle is going to be going first with opening statements.
Okay, all right, thank you, Joe. Also thank you to our panel for being here. And I want to thank the sponsors of this debate, and I want to thank you, people in the audience who turned out tonight to listen to us. You may be surprised, but I also want to thank Albert Rowland. The reason I want to thank him is I want to thank him for running for office. It's not easy to put your name on the ballot. It's not easy to commit yourself to the critique of being in front of the voters, talking about the issues, having people complain about you, whatever the case may be. I have always said that no one should run unopposed, and I am serious about that, whether it's county board or state assembly or president of the United States. We should always have to answer to the people, and the best way to do that is to have an opponent run against you for office. So thank you, Albert, for running. I was born and raised in La Crosse County here. Grew up on the north side of La Crosse. Lived there until we moved up to Onalaska in 1969. And during that time, I've seen a lot of changes in our community. When I was growing up on the north side of La Crosse, we didn't lock our doors at night. We felt safe walking around the community. We had almost no minority members of our community. The University of Wisconsin-La Crosse was a school that you could get into if you couldn't get in anywhere else. And if you look at what has happened since then, we are a bustling, thriving community, not always safe sometimes. We do have some criminal justice issues in our community. But we have a university system in Wisconsin that is second to none, and University of Wisconsin-La Crosse that is the second most difficult school to get into in the entire university system, something that we have a lot to be proud of. We have two other institutions of higher education. We have two medical facilities in La Crosse County. So we are doing well, in my opinion. And I'm proud to be a member of this community. And I'm proud to be a person who's been a leader in this community. When I was 29 years old, I decided to run for the county board and got elected, eventually serving as county board chair here in La Crosse. Was able to keep our local property taxes and our spending in La Crosse County the fifth lowest of any county in the state of Wisconsin. So out of 72 counties, we were the fifth lowest. I'm really proud of that because we offered a lot of good services. We have a very efficient, very effective government, but we're also very sensitive to taxpayers. And those are the kinds of things that I hope that we talk about tonight, what that vision of government is and where we've been, but also where we can go in terms of improving our community here in La Crosse area and improving the entire state of Wisconsin. So thank you again for being here. I look forward to an interesting discussion tonight.
Mr. Rowland.
Thanks, everybody, for being here this evening. Not necessarily used to a huge audience. I think the last time we did this, it was 30 people in a room? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a little bit, a couple more people. I was born and raised in a Filipino orphanage in the Queen City of Philippines in Manila. So when I immigrated here, I was 8. That is a very interesting process. A lot of it, I felt like a pincushion, that anyone has ever joined the Air Force or any branch of the military, you get a lot of shots. It was like it happened all over again when I joined the Air Force. I got a lot of shots. I believe my shot records and my adoption records are 4 pages. It's just one line after another line. Diseases that you never even heard of. In my case, I only spoke 100 words of English. So clearly, I had no idea what those shots were. But it's a very long process. And it wasn't until years later I found out it's an expensive process for my parents to do this. It took, my dad was serving as a pastor in Arlington, Minnesota when he started. When I finally immigrated, he had already moved back to Grandpa's farm that had been in the family for 50, 60 years. It's quite a scene to go from an orphanage where there's a sea of people to looking out your window and it's corn, wheat, oats, and dairy cows. Never want to be in dairy farming again, thank God. But went to Onwithi. It's about 2.5 hours from here. It's a really small town. 500 people. The sign says friendly, depending on who you are. Could be. But after graduating, I went to St. Louis because I wanted to be in the big city again. I moved in with my dad's youngest brother, who was a colonel in the Air Force, and that began my 14-year career in the Air Force. I still am in the reserves, and you know, it's 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year. Sometimes you want to go, but other times you don't. But it's been a good choice for me. It's been a good role for me to be in. I still work in a civilian job. I currently work at Great Lakes Cheese. I think it's about my 4th year. It's probably the best paying job I've ever had. And obviously, you're back in dairy. But at least it's not milking cows twice a day. It's a lot better. But it's really been an interesting run to be a candidate for office versus helping candidates run for office. And they said it was going to be an adventure, and boy, it has been.
The first question is going to come from Martha Kolaski to Steve Doyle.
At a time when politics can be anything but civil or bipartisan, if you are elected, in which issues or areas can you see yourself reaching across the aisle to come up with solutions?
All of them. Oh, you want me to talk more about that? Well, that, you know, in Madison, I'm known as Mr. Bipartisan. In fact, if you go online and type in www.mrbipartisan.com, that'll take you to my website, because that is how much I believe in bipartisanship. Being a bipartisan legislator doesn't mean I am a Republican. I mean, I'm a Democrat, and I believe in the things that Democrats believe in. But I also believe that there are so many areas where we intersect and that we have a lot in common. I am so proud to be the Democratic co-chair of the Speaker Task Force on Foster Care this session. We passed 11 bills that and almost all of them passed on a unanimous vote. I was able to work with Republicans and Democrats alike on our committee to help kids who are abused and neglected and the foster parents that help take care of them. And we said over and over, you know, kids who are abused and neglected aren't Democrats, they're not Republicans, they are children. And the solutions to their problems, to their plight, aren't Democratic solutions, aren't Republican solutions, they're human solutions. So when I said all of them, there are no issues out there that we can't work together on, whether it's transportation or whether it's healthcare or whether it's, you know, economic development or improving our education system or broadband access in the rural areas. There are so many areas where we can find ways to work together that it should be easier to find those areas of commonality than finding the areas we disagree in.
Okay, Mr. Rowland.
I agree with Steve. If I can get a microphone to work. You know, in my 14 years in a variety of agencies, specifically the Air Force, you really were not seen as a political asset. That it just didn't matter. As far as your political attitudes, they just were worried about can you do the job, and it, as far as politics, it's just a non-issue for the Air Force. And as I've been knocking on doors, most of my issues, it was not right or left. It was we need the job done well, and I believe you could be the next person.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Mark Wears, the La Crosse Tribune.
Our readers value the environment we live in a great deal. It's a beautiful place we live in. The Department of Natural Resources today has fewer scientists and conducts less onerous regulation enforcement than it did 8 years ago. Have those trends benefited Wisconsin?
Roland goes first.
Roland.
I grew up on a farm, so I'm kind of used to the DNR. You know, they're more of a friend. You have to deal with them all the time. Obviously you become more of an environmentalist when you're born and raised on a farm. And that's, I have been a little bit troubled with what's happening to the DNR, because as far as I'm concerned, they were more of a friend on the farm. That's how I got to know them, you know. I knew them as people in green outfits. And, you know, that's just, for me, it was, I have a little problem with the DNR being cut like it is, because I didn't see them as an evil. I saw them as a friend and kind of a handshake agreement that they looked out, not just for you, but everybody around you.
Steve?
The League of Conservation Voters has endorsed me and has given me an award for the third or fourth term in a row as a friend of the environment. And I am proud of that designation. The Department of Natural Resources really should be the front line in protecting our environment. But unfortunately, what we've seen over the last years is an erosion of that authority. When the governor a couple budgets ago eliminated most of the scientists within the department, that wasn't a good sign. When wardens come up to me and say, you know, I don't feel like I'm appreciated or have any use anymore, that's not a good sign. When people in the Department of Natural Resources in Madison, you know, come to hearings and tell me, you know, we don't know what the mission of our agency is anymore, that's not a good sign. It's not a good direction that we're going. We need to recognize that it takes a long, long time to create a good, healthy living environment, but it doesn't take long at all to destroy that. And that's what we're seeing in terms of the attitude today, unfortunately. It looks like it's, you know, if we can make some quick money today, let's not worry about the future. If we can, You'll make some money even if it pollutes a stream, even if it takes water out of Lake Michigan, even if it makes the groundwater unsafe for our families. As long as we're making money, that's okay. I don't buy into that methodology. I don't buy into that philosophy. And I'm going to continue to work on behalf of the environment. And I'm hoping 2 years from now, I'm going to be able to stand here again and say that the League of Conservation Voters has again named me a friend of the environment.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Dave Soli of WXOW.
Thank you, Joe. What is one issue you would either like to propose or continue to work on that you believe would provide the greatest value for most of the people you represent?
There's a lot of them out there. The foster care project that I was involved in was really important, and we got a start on that, but there's so much more that we can do. But if I had to pick one, I think it's going to be education, because education isn't an expenditure, it's an investment. It's an investment in our children, it's an investment in our future. And we are in the process of going from one of the most highly respected systems in the country to one that is so-so, and that is not acceptable. In my law practice, I work with people in the real estate business all the time, and if you ask any realtor, if somebody is thinking of moving into your community, what's the first question they ask you? They don't ask, what are the taxes like, believe it or not. They ask, what are your schools like? They want to move into a place where their kids are going to get a good education. And if that realtor has to say, schools are okay, but hey, we've got whatever, that's not going to be good enough. That's not a recipe for good economic development in your state or in your community. So I want to see us recommit to that idea of the state picking up the cost of two-thirds of the cost of education. I think that is critical. I think we have to get out of this operation by referendum. When a school district has to go to referendum to keep the lights on, to pay for their operating expenses, that means that the state is no longer paying those costs. Those are shifted to the property taxpayers. That isn't fair. That's not a good, stable, secure way to run an educational system. So that's where I would put my greatest effort, is to making our schools, again, second to none.
Okay. Mr. Rowland?
My feeling is actually infrastructure. Roads, bridges, broadband internet. It's not just the state or the county or the district, it's also all over the United States. We were not actually able to fly in a couple of bases in the last month, just because, oddly enough, the airport just wouldn't support our C-130. It's a nationwide challenge. But also at the same time, regardless if you have a healthy economy or a poor economy, specifically in a healthy economy, you need those roads, bridges, infrastructure, just to continue to either get the economy running or continue to keep the economy going. You can have the best schools in the world, but if you can't even get to the school, kind of defeats the purpose of having a great school. You're out in the middle of nowhere, and how do you get there? Oddly enough, 90 to 95% of the world's goods, stuff you get from Amazon, it comes through on a set of wheels. Not by an aircraft, not by sea or ship. It gets there on a set of wheels, and infrastructure is the way is how it gets there. It should account for 60% of any municipality's budget, keeping that up to date, and we have failed. It's nationally, state, county-wise, and district-wise, but it is a challenge, and it's an attainable challenge to upgrade, if not fix.
Thank you. Next question comes from Hope Kirwan, WLSU. Goes to Albert.
Recent testing by the La Crosse County Health Department found 30% of private wells tested in the town of Holland and the town of Onalaska exceeded the federal limit for nitrates, a chemical compound linked to a variety of health problems. What can the state legislature do to help residents who have contaminated wells and prevent future contamination?
Well, my immediate belief is fund the DNR more than, versus cutting it, fund it better. And yes, add the scientists back in. Now, we obviously don't want to see Detroit happening here in those two towns. But it also would help if we had enforced the environmental laws before you even got that far. And that it shows what you don't, when you neglect to keep that careful balance of enforcement of environmental laws, and not just environmental laws, but just common sense. You know, I grew up on a farm. You are the steward of the land that you're living on, and it's not going to be just your generation. It's going to be future generations, and it's more so neglect as to what has happened in that town.
Okay, thank you. Steve?
Again, I want to give kudos to our county government. They are the ones who caught this issue. They are the ones who pushed this issue. This happens to be in my state assembly district, and so it is a really significant issue for me. With regard to what we can do, the health department, when this issue first came about, suggested that we have legislation related to notifying homeowners when toxicity or contamination is discovered in wells in their particular area. Our La Crosse area delegation introduced legislation, made it through the assembly, didn't make it through the Senate. We're going to do it again. I also asked the health department to send me a copy of the report from their study committee to my Madison office to see what suggestions that they have in their series of recommendations require some state involvement. Sometimes it would require state legislation. Sometimes it would require administrative rule changes. Sometimes it would just take a little bit of cheerleading to push things along and to bring some attention to those issues. And so I wanted to get on top of that so that when we go back into session in January, we have legislation ready to go.
Thank you. Next question comes from Wisdom's Brad Williams.
I want to get back to roads and transportation. La Crosse County especially is going to look at funding options, asking people on referendum to decide what they prefer as far as local funding to repair roads, to build roads and bridges. And it is involved in the governor's race as well, candidates asking should everything be on the table. What would you propose as what you would like to see done to give more road money to the local governments? What would be the best way?
I've talked with a lot of our local businesses, whether it be Quick Trip or City Brewing or some of our small mom and pop operations, and every one of them says the same thing. We can't just ignore the problem. We can't just pretend it's going to get better. It's going to take some heavy lifting to deal with this, and that heavy lifting comes in the form of we have to figure out a way to raise revenue. My preferred route in that regard would be to have a modest increase in the gas tax, 5 or 10 cents per gallon, and let's see what kind of a start that provides. That, by the way, is the same position that my Republican colleagues in the legislature had in the last budget go-round. You recall that our state budget passed 3 months late because the fight between the governor and the Republicans and the legislature was over the issue of transportation funding. I support what Robin Voss and my Republican colleagues in the legislature were trying to accomplish because they recognized that this is a problem that needs to be addressed and it needs to be addressed now. I was glad to hear that Governor Walker is finally coming around and saying we need to increase spending for our roads in the state of Wisconsin. What he didn't say was where that money is going to come from. So does that mean that he is open to any particular type of a tax or an increase in fees or what? We're not sure about that. We also know that in the past he has said, well, if we increase something here, we've got a decrease over here. So where is that going to come from? You know, going back to my comments about foster care, if we start to take money away from kids and families for the roads, that's not a good choice. That's not the way I want to look at the situation. What I want to do is to figure out, you know, where can we get some consensus? I've said I think that a modest increase in the gas tax makes sense. It's probably going to involve some sort of a combination of things like minor fee increases and economization and so forth. But you know, I think we need to start talking.
Mr. Olin.
Well, I have talked to the governor, and it's probably been in the last 60 days, and I agree with him. We may have to increase the gas tax, but commencement with either eliminating taxes or outright reducing, in a broad sense, the taxes all the way around, and to kind of balance so that we're not taxing more. It's kind of an even balance. So yes, something is going to either eliminating taxes or as a whole reducing taxes to compensate for the increase in the gas tanks. I agree with that. It's you know, Wisconsin being one of the higher tax states, it's not a bad option. Sharing the load for what should have been addressed generations ago.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Catherine Kolkmeyer, the League of Women Voters.
Gerrymandering has been brought up as one of the top issues in this state, and I'm wondering, would you support the creation of a nonpartisan process for redistricting the state legislative districts, and if not, what would you propose?
Okay, Mr. Rowland.
You know, any party that's a minority party, and both parties have been, always feel it's always against them when you call it gerrymandering, but the other party will say it's just the way it is. It's fair game. You had it your way. It's now our turn. It's the only system, to be honest, that I'm familiar with. I don't know. I don't call it gerrymandering. It's just whoever is in power. Everybody always feels disadvantaged if you're in the minority power.
Okay. Mr. Doyle?
I call it gerrymandering because it's gerrymandering. I mean, that's what it is. And when the Republicans do it in Wisconsin, it's a bad thing. When the Democrats do it in states out east, it's a bad thing. I mean, it's gerrymandering. It needs to change. There was a bill in the last session of the legislature that I co-sponsored to have Wisconsin go to the Iowa model, where you have an independent commission or agency, such as the Legislative Reference Bureau, to handle handle redistricting. And the way that process works is they put together their proposed maps and you vote up or down. You can't do any amendments. What I think, though, is that that's a first step. But I don't want to have some party, whether it's the Democrats or Republicans, in the future say, you know, now that we've got some control, we're going to get rid of that law. We're going to go back to the old way. So I also, when we are back in session in January, want to see that that is also introduced as a constitutional amendment so that it's in the Constitution. You don't have one party that can say they're going to, you know, rig the rules of the game going forward. So, yes, I support nonpartisan redistricting, and I want to see it done both ways.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Martha Kolaski.
Well, here we are on the campus of UW-La Crosse, so it seemed appropriate to ask, with the average college graduate finishing school with $30,000 in college loans, what things do you think that Wisconsin legislators could do to reduce tuition or debt to address this?
You know, when I was a student here at UW-La Crosse, I was involved in student government, and we had a program one semester when students were registering, the old-fashioned way where you had to do it on paper. We all got in line and showed up on the same day. We had people sign a thing called Operation Tuition Check, and we were asking the legislature to pass a law that the student share of tuition would never exceed one-third. Well, students today know that that has flipped. It's now the opposite. The state has really backed away from what I consider its obligation. So not only have we seen tuition historically increasing because of the cost of living, but also increasing because the state is backing out what it's doing for its share. Now, we've had tuition freezes for the last few years in Wisconsin, which gives some temporary relief, but what it does also is it masks an underlying problem. And that underlying problem is that we're underfunding education in Wisconsin. For as depressing as it is to know that the average student has got a debt load of $25,000, $30,000, every year the dental students come to Madison on dental day, and I always ask them one question, which is, what's the average debt load of a graduating dental student? You know what it is? It's about $365,000. I mean, that is depressing. We can't keep doing that. To go back to something that I said earlier in the debate, education isn't just an expenditure, it's an investment. And if we want to have people want to come to Wisconsin, want to stay in Wisconsin, want to raise a family in Wisconsin, open a business in Wisconsin, we have to make education affordable and quality. And so the state needs to revisit what our obligation is to the university system, to the tech school system, so that we go back to the quality that we used to have.
Thank you. Mr. Rowland.
Education is an investment. And watching my sister send three daughters through college, that was the priority. So they set aside a lot of money. And despite that, all three still worked in the summer did part-time jobs, despite the investments that that Lewis and Florian made. If you make education a priority, it's an investment. Yes, you're going to have to scrimp and save. I mean, there were times that I can remember Lewis and Florian saying, hey, we can't do that because we have got three people that got to get through college. And yes, they still made those sacrifices up front. And I believe right now, I think with Nicole, she actually, due to scholarships, now this is a lot of long-term planning. Again, when you're sending three kids through college, there's a lot of long-term planning. But she had a lot of it paid for through scholarships. And of course, mom and dad did a lot of, you know, they started this when they were one. So yeah, having stocks and bonds and just all around making sure that education is funded. It was done on a personal basis. It didn't involve a loan. It didn't involve anything other than scholarships and proper investments. It, you know, and tuition freeze, it helps, but you can't continue to do that forever either. So eventually you are going to experience a hike in tuition sooner or later.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from the Tribune's Mark Wares.
This part of the state is facing challenges created by both methamphetamine and opioid abuse. What should be the state's role in helping overmatched county social services and criminal justice systems deal with that?
Okay. It is, and it's not just a challenge, you know, it's for a challenge for everybody. But a lot of it, even when I went through a recent operation here, it's one of those things that when you have an operation, you're going to experience some pain. I certainly did. But we have to consider alternatives other than opiates. And there's a lot of facets here that we're not considering. Doctors are being pushed by pharmaceutical companies to push the opiates in order to avoid the pain. We kind of have to consider health pain aversion alternatives. Mine was chiropractic. I did a lot of that, and I did massages to get over the pain. It's a lot of, I mean, TOMA is a great example of what happens when you only choose one option for pain aversion. It really made a lot of our VA benefits very dependent on it, and it contributed to the problem more than it solved it. But it's an easy solution. It's not a long-term solution, and we certainly society is paying for that. But you have to consider pain aversion options other than just a needle.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Doyle.
In the last couple legislative sessions, we've passed, in both sessions, we've passed a package of bills related to the opioid crisis, and it has everything from some funding for treatment to the program where there's a central database so that if I go to, you know, Shopko and fill my prescription, and then next time I go to Walgreens, and then I go down the road to somewhere else, that is going to be caught that I'm doing that. And by the way, next session, we need to expand that to veterinarians, because that's what people are doing now, is they're taking their dog or their cat in to get opioids, and then they're using them for themselves. I want to tell you a story that I heard when we were traveling around the state as part of the foster care task force. We're up in north of here, and we had the human services director from Clark County come in, and he talked about the impact of opioids on people. And he said, you know, when you use those drugs, it gets into your system, but then it comes back out through your pores. And if you are a parent and you're holding that child in your arms, guess what? That is going into that child system. And they were testing kids in Clark County that had higher levels of opioids in their system than their parents did. It got so bad that when social workers were called out to those cases, they were wearing hazmat suits because those kids were dangerous for a social worker to be around. I mean, that's the kind of crisis that we're dealing with in this state. So what are the answers? We've only started on that. There is so much more to do. The biggest problem that we're seeing right now is the unavailability of treatment. I mean, you can get sentenced by a court to, you know, some probation. As part of that probation, you have to get treatment, but the programs aren't around, or they're 2 hours away. We're never going to solve this problem by thinking that somebody's going to do, you know, a two-week or 30-day fix and then they're going to be cured and never use drugs again. So until we get serious about the treatment aspect of this, it's not going to change. That's the first thing that we need to do.
Okay, thank you. Dave Soley.
Thank you, Joe. What is your position on the legalization of marijuana for people 21 and older?
Well, that is an issue that is on the ballot for La Crosse County this November. My wife is a judge. She's here tonight. She and I have an agreement on most issues. That was one that we don't necessarily agree upon. She sees the downside of drugs in her courtroom almost every day, and I respect that. I talk to a lot of people who say, you know, I understand the dangers. I'm an adult. I want to be able to make the decision myself, and I respect that too. Now, that doesn't mean that it's just wholesale. We're just going to, party down for the rest of our life and turn into, you know, some sort of a haven for drugs. I think that it is important to do, if we do have legalization, and that would be, from my perspective, if the voters say that that is a good idea, then I think we need to look at the control of it. I think it needs to be regulated so that it's safe. That's one of the reasons that I do favor it, because at least we can control the potency of the drug, where right now it's really out of control, and it can be laced with things. It can be, you know, higher potency than people expect. So I think that we can make it a safer drug. I know many people who are suffering from debilitating diseases that would do anything to be able to get a little bit of pain relief, and that's the only thing that works for them. So, you know, in that regard, what the people of my district have been telling me when I've asked them is probably two-thirds of them are saying, you know, it's probably time that we look at legalizing it. But, my final comment is I want to see what the voters of my district have to say in November in terms of, you know, my ultimate vote in that regard.
Okay. Mr. Rowland?
I think we can take a look at an example of the state of Washington and Colorado. As far as the unintended consequences of legalizing marijuana, and yes, it the perception that marijuana is not that lethal, it's not addictive. If you look at those, what the results have been in Colorado and Washington, there has the benefits thereof as far as tax revenue has really, it flip-flopped. Now, you know, the benefits has not something you can see in 5 years or 10 years, but even in the 10 years that you've seen Washington have it and Colorado have it, even there, it's the benefits have been outweighed by the addictive nature of marijuana and the consequences of people who are not producing it and properly processing it. I have no real opinion on marijuana as a whole. I just don't, it's just not my thing. So I just, as a whole, I'm not really for or against it, but I'm more interested in the long term, 10, 20, 30 years. Has it really been all that beneficial?
Thank you. Next question comes from Hope Kirwan, WLSU.
How has a shortage of workers impacted your district, and what can the state do to fill this need?
Well, I see it at work. The shortage of workers leaves you with, well, working harder for the same amount of pay you're getting. So, but that means you got to go to a healthy economy at the same time, and you're likely to see a wage increase. And certainly since I've been working at Great Lakes Cheese, that raises have been annually. So yes, as much as a challenge, it's also a blessing. But it is a case where we are gonna have to, and it's just, and this, I look at it from a manufacturing point of view, but we do have to let people aware that, hey, being a welder is not a bad deal. I mean, it's a $90,000 job for going to college, tech school for less than 2 years. It's not a bad deal. But you do have to look at, hey, you know, you kind of have to expand your horizons as far as the working shortage. You might have to dip into a different pool of candidates to fill that gap.
Thank you. Mr. Doyle.
The first bill that I ever passed was the Workforce Adjustment Training Grant Bill, and that was an idea that I got from Patty Belichick at Western Technical College, which is a way of bringing the job creators, the businesses of our community together with state government, in particular the tech school system, to figure out what the needs are and what the solutions are. So we passed that bill, and companies can now come to a technical school system, a campus near them, and say, okay, we need more welders, we need more nurses, those are the two we hear all the time these days, or we need more whatever. And can you help us? And so with these Watt grants, the tech school is able to create either a department or even just a room in their facility to focus on that particular need. And so the businesses will a lot of times provide equipment, computers, machinery, what have you. Sometimes they'll provide consultants or experts to show what exactly it is that the students need to be taught. And then on the flip side, we have people who are dislocated from their prior job. A company has closed or something happened where they lost their job, so they're looking for something. So we have this need over here. We have people here who are possible workers, but they don't quite have the training. Now we've matched them up. And that's the beauty of public-private partnerships, where we figure out, is there a way that we can get a value-added product by having the government work together with the private sector? We do that in La Crosse County all the time with our Economic Development Fund. It can be done at the state level, and this program in particular is really proud of that bill that, again, passed on a near unanimous vote in both houses of the legislature. Governor came to my district to sign it then. So.
Thank you. Brad Williams, WISM.
There are concerns in the campaign for governor and certainly in local communities about law and order, the prison population, whether it's too high or not, whether people are being released too soon, let out of jail after being charged. What would you like to see the state do right now to improve the justice system and make the state safer?
I would like the state to take a look at La Crosse County. We have had a criminal justice management council in La Crosse County for probably a couple decades now, and I was a member of that when I was county board chair. And what we do in La Crosse County is try to focus on evidence-based practices for everything that we do. And so when we have programs in La Crosse, for example, like our drug court or our drunk driving court or our veterans court, we look at examples of how it can work best. So in some cases, it may be that you are concerned about putting youthful or minor offenders in jails or prison with the more hardcore criminals, where what you're doing is you're teaching the newbies, if you will, how to be better criminals. You know, we're trying to avoid that. One of the things that we were taught was a good way of looking at it from a judge over across the river who used to say, what you need to do is to figure out, you know, who you're mad at and who you're afraid of. The people that you're afraid of, you have to lock them up. There's really nothing else you can do. The people you're mad at, the people who did something stupid, but aren't necessarily a life threat or a safety threat, there are other alternatives for people like that. And so that's what we need to do, is to determine where to draw that line and then to make those programs available. And I really give our local judges credit in that regard, because we have been cutting edge in terms of successful programs. We have people come to La Crosse from all over the country to see how we do things in La Crosse. So best thing the folks in Madison could do was drive west, spend a little bit of time here in La Crosse County, talk to our judges, our social workers, our probation agents, our sheriff, our police officers, find out how we do it here, because I think that we're onto something here.
Okay, thank you. Albert.
We also, in Wisconsin, we had that Huber Law, where you spend your day shift, night shift, whatever shift you were working during that time frame, and then you went back to jail. It's kind of that incentive to get out of jail, to eventually, you already had a job, and it kind of gave you that incentive to not be going back to this place, going back to, to where you're in a very small cell. I lived in St. Louis for 10 years. I don't know what they called it in Missouri, but it was very similar. They had, safety houses. It was similar to they would spend 6 months going back to a jail, and then after a while, they spent 90 days going to what they call a safe house. Basically, you were sharing, just like you do with college students, your fellow college students, you're sharing a house, 5-bedroom house. And after 90 days, if you continue to behave well, you then could go off on your own. And there's actually, Missouri kind of had a long-term plan. They looked at not just how you did 1 year afterwards, but in some cases 2 or 3 years, depending on the level of crime. There's a lot of stupid crimes people do that doesn't require them to be in jail for years. But we're almost better off giving them a fine and then sending them on their merry way, hoping they don't come back. And these are, you're not scared of them, but you're just thinking, you really shouldn't have done that. You're not angry at them, but you're frustrated with what that pattern of behavior, because chances are they're going to do it again. But at least it's not putting them in jail for a very long time, and unfortunately, going back to jail any longer than 6 months, at least Missouri's experience was, tends to be that tipping point where they're there for a longer time, for years.
Okay, thank you.
If I can do a quick follow-up.
Sure.
La Crosse County was the second county in the state of Wisconsin to close our Huber facility. And the reason that we did that was because we ran the math and decided that it doesn't make sense for the taxpayers to pay for somebody to be housed in a facility when we can make them pay for their own ankle bracelet and be confined to their own home so we can monitor their activities. And it's safer that way, it's cheaper that way. They're paying for the cost of their incarceration rather than the taxpayer. So we were really proud to be, again, leaders in that area.
Okay, thank you. Could we shorten the questions, the answers to about 1 minute for the next round, and we'll get through it.
Sure.
Okay, Catherine Koltmeyer, please.
What do you consider to be the role of the state legislature in ensuring that all citizens have an adequate opportunity to cast an informed vote?
Roland.
Well, I guess I look at it from an immigrant's point of view. I really would rather trust my instincts. I tend to do a lot of reading, regardless of the candidate. I'm the guy that, when it was 2016, I saw all 17. Republican candidates, and I saw all 7 Democrat candidates, the ones I was aware of anyhow. So I tend to, and again, maybe it's just because I'm a first generation immigrant, but I really pay attention to what he or she is saying, and it's not something I was encouraged by a third party. It was my initiative, my self-drive to say who is a better candidate regardless of the party. It's not something I say, hey, the state's supposed to be responsible for that. That's you. You're the answer. Ultimately, look in the mirror because you're the one that has to vote, not the state.
Okay, thank you. Steve?
Your question really has 2 aspects to it, vote and be informed. So the vote part, I have very, very strong feelings on that with regard to how difficult it has become to vote in Wisconsin because of a lot of the voter suppression laws that we've seen in terms of, you know, IDs that older people are not able to get because they don't have a driver's license, or people in rural areas have a hard time getting because the closest DOT office is an hour away and they're only open 2 days a week. You know, it's those kind of things that discourage people from voting. So I'm very concerned about that, and I want to reverse those things. It shouldn't be that, you know, you can just, you know, walk in, never be a registered voter, and suddenly cast a ballot. I think that there's certainly some logic to making sure that we have, you know, fair and transparent elections. But we've gone really to the extent of making it difficult for people to vote. Secondly, the informed part. And that's where you folks from the League of Women Voters come in. The educational programs. La Crosse County is doing an educational program with regard to the transportation questions on the ballot in November. And so, you know, it's that kind of thing I think is also an important
part. Mr. Rowland, you have a response?
You know, as far as transportation, getting to and from, you know, to register to vote or even to vote, I really didn't have a problem when my car broke down in 2016 to go out and vote. I actually voted early because I knew I may not have a car that day. As far as ID, when I was a union member for the United States Postal Service, you had to have an ID to vote for that union. I don't see it being a problem. And you're looking from a first generation immigrant. It's harder to get an ID when you're a first generation immigrant or any immigrant, let alone should you be shot, required to have a photo ID? I'm not.
Okay, thank you. Next question, Martha Kolaski.
We did touch on this a little bit earlier, but I wanted you both to have the opportunity to answer the same question that La Crosse County voters will be answering in an advisory referendum on November 6th, and that is, when it comes to paying for the roads, what would you prefer, the Pratt tax, a wheel tax, an increase in your property taxes, or push for greater state funding?
Mr. Earl, 1 minute.
To be honest, the state of Wisconsin has chosen to increase their funding from 28% to 30%. But as far as are we falling short in funding the roads, I'm looking at a 10-year record where the county has essentially reduced spending money on roads. So it's not, you know, a case of, hey, are we running out of revenue? We're not actually spending the revenue we do have on roads in the first place. Now, 5-7 years ago, we had a 5% a half percent increase on taxes. It's $12 million. That was 5-7 years ago. What happened to that money? Where did it go to? Your guess is as good as mine, but I'm looking at a 10-year record. It certainly didn't go to the roads, because that's $12 million a year.
Mr. Doyle.
You need to look on your Republican Party's Facebook page to see the response from one of our county board members to the chart that you're referring to there, because the chart that you have is wrong chart. Transportation funding in La Crosse has gone up modestly over the past few years, but state assistance, in fact, has been flat or in some cases has been reduced. La Crosse County is not alone. I mean, I keep hearing people say, well, La Crosse County needs to, you know, reshuffle its priorities. You're spending money on the wrong thing. Every county in the state of Wisconsin, with the exception of Washington County, by the way, which is the richest county in the state, every other county in the state is in crisis mode. Almost every town, village, and city in the state is having a problem funding education. It's not just us. So you can't say our priorities are mixed up. The answer to those questions, my response on that is I want to hear what the voters have to say. Because 2 years ago, I told my county board colleagues that if that referendum passes, I'll introduce the bill. I thought, that's safe. I won't have to worry about that. It's not going to pass. Well, guess what? The voters of La Crosse County said, we want to have that tax, the premier resort area tax. And so I introduced the bill. And I'm going to do whatever the voters tell me this time also, because that's how democracy works.
Mark Wears.
Was the state's deal to land Foxconn worth the price in tax credits and regulatory waivers? And why or why not?
Mr. Doyle.
I am really concerned about the Foxconn deal. And not that I'm opposed to bringing in new businesses, because in La Crosse County, we've done that again through our Economic Development Fund. But when we're talking about $4.5 billion and then changing the rules so that the court system is tilted toward them, I have a real concern, and here's a couple points that I would make. Point number one. $4.5 billion, and the company has said, well, we're going to create 13,000 jobs for that. So $4.5 billion to create 13,000 jobs is $346,000 a job. Let's say there's a ripple effect, and, you know, so the suppliers and other companies can create jobs as a result of that, too. Let's say that we create 50,000 jobs because of Foxconn. That's $90,000 a job. Why aren't we just going out on the street corner handing out $100 bills? Because that is going to be just as effective. I think that's a mistake. Secondly, it's targeted the wrong area. We're spending $4.5 billion to bring people from Chicago to Wisconsin to get these jobs. This doesn't help Western Wisconsin. This helps Chicago.
Mr. Olin?
You know, as far as municipalities providing tax incentives, all municipalities do it. We did so in the West Salem Industrial Park. We provided an incentive. The company I worked for, Sprint, they were there for 18, 20 months, and they packed up and left. They literally sent their call center overseas. All municipalities do this. As far as Foxconn, every single one of us have a large screen cell phone in our pocket. So look in the mirror. You're part of that cause as to why Foxconn came, not just to Michigan, not just to Wisconsin, but they also shop with Minnesota and Illinois. Yes, my personal preference is if they want to come, great. But I prefer not to be giving tax dollars away. As far as the amount of money essentially each employee is getting, or that Foxconn is getting per employee, my personal experience with the Air Force, it does cost a lot of money to continuously train people on all new technologies. That's just the end cost of doing business.
Thank you.
Can I follow up briefly?
Quickly.
My other concern with regard to the Foxconn deal is we're putting all of our eggs in one basket. We're putting all of our resources into one company. You know, folks thought that Sony Betamax was the best idea ever. People thought that Blackberries were the best idea ever. Well, where are those products today? Foxconn is known for one product, flat screen TVs. When that's replaced by whatever the newest idea is next, are we going to be in the same situation that companies or that states a number of years ago thought that, you know, the Saturn plant was the best investment they could possibly do, and then Saturn plants have now closed all across the country. That's my concern.
Last question, Dave Soley. 1 minute responses, and then we're going to go to the closing statements.
Since 2000, this university sponsored a Nobel Prize winner in physics. This year it was Dr. Barry Barish, who was talking about the U.S. Congress when he said, there's one scientist there, and lawmakers typically don't listen to us on science issues. Would you just respond to what he said using the state legislature as an example?
Go ahead, Steve.
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
The legislatures and elected officials don't listen to scientists?
That was his argument about the U.S. Congress, yes.
I think that tends to be true, because we are, as elected officials, usually jacks of all trade and master of none. And so we have to figure out who we're going to listen to. I have an office in Madison where lobbyists and what we refer to as citizen lobbyists come in and talk to us all the time. And what tends to be the case is that we listen to the squeaky wheel. So if a company sends in somebody to meet with me, that's who I listen to. We don't always have the opportunity to listen to the experts. And, you know, at our committee meetings, sometimes I've been there where it's been discouraging because people that you know have an educational background, whether it's a scientist or a person with a PhD in something else, sometimes we think that we know better than them because we're the ones who got elected. And that's really unfortunate, but I think it does happen at all levels of government.
Mr. Olin.
I can certainly tell you that even some of the scientists that I've spoken to, even on base, they said, boy, we feel the same way. We feel like when we're talking to you, it doesn't take long for your eyes to glaze over. But in the world of politics, if you can't get your message in this short a time, yeah, that's why a guy's got a point. You can't break down science in four sentences. It's very hard. But as a legislator, you really should pay attention, just from personal experience.
Okay, thank you. Now we're going into closing statements. Let's see, Mr. Rowland, go first.
Well, it's for me, the reason I ran is just because of the reverence for how this country is built. It's the basic concept of free will. It's countries talk about it. It's one thing to talk about it, but when you build an entire nation on that concept and you fight for it day in, day out, and even today, it's more of a verbal conversation. It's not involving arms, although, you know, as a member of the United States Air Force, it tends to be. But it's in a very, for me, it's a very gravitating, you know, reason to be in this country, to work and be of service to this country. It's the reason why this is the number one immigrated and sought after country, because it's everywhere. You know, we've had foreign exchange students live with us for years, and they're just really stunned at just how free you are, just how much there's, you know, some of the immigrants that lived with us, they were just stunned that, you mean you're not gonna have to call somebody to go here, to go there. One of the immigrants we had just was really surprised when she stepped into the grocery store every single time, the shelves are full. It just shocked her that type of availability to just decide, hey, I'm gonna go here, and there's no limit. You can hop public transportation, it'll get you there, and when you get there, it's not a line. It's typically, you can do it yourself. You can pick up your own groceries, and you're not limited to however you want to be limited. That is a very attractive thing, and it's primarily just the sheer reverence of how, you know, that type of freedom. God, faith, and family, this is, you just live it. That's something that's really unusual.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Doyle.
You know, sometimes when I turn on the television or the radio or go to my mailbox and I just see or hear those attack ads, it just gets so discouraging because, I mean, it's no longer why you should vote for this good candidate or this good idea. It's why you should vote against this bad person or this bad idea. And even when I get discouraged, though, I always tell myself, can't quit. You got to do what you can to change the tone. And that is what I have tried to do in my entire political career. As county board chairman, we called it collaboration. First thing that I did, first major project I did as county board chair was the Household Hazardous Materials Program, where I went to every municipality in La Crosse County and said, hey, we can all do this individually, or we could get together and we pool our money and we can create this program. We still have that program. I also went to the Village of West Salem and LADCO and CenturyLink and XL Energy and said, you know, we can create a business park out at West Salem, and if we all work together, business and government, and we can create jobs. And, you know, you felt good doing something positive. In local government, we call that collaboration. Now that I'm in a partisan environment, I call it bipartisanship. And I'm doing the same thing. You know, the foster care package of bills is probably my proudest moment in the state legislature, because we found something that was a problem that we could agree was a problem, and we could come up with solutions that we could agree were solutions. That's what I want to continue to do in Madison, is to change that tone. I don't want to yell at people. I don't want to have them yell back at me. I want to sit down with them, pull out a piece of paper and a pen, and start writing down ideas and get things done together. That has been my history in my entire political career. That's what I want to continue doing for the next 2 years and hopefully well beyond that. So thank you very much for coming tonight.
I'd like to close by thanking our panel members for really outstanding questions. I'd like to thank our candidates, Steve Doyle and Albert Rowland, and I think they all deserve a round of applause.